Welcome to the Hackberry House of Chosun. My name is Bob, and I'm reading today from the last message of Daniel. It's my own commentary on the last three chapters of the book of Daniel. We've gotten deep into the prophecy now. We're in chapter 11, and I'd like you to join with me there in verse 5. The first part of the verse says, "Then the king of the south shall become strong." Well, he is a boyhood friend of Alexander the Great, the son of a Macedonian named Lagus. He's taken into Alexander's army, slowly rises within the ranks, in the general group of the king's bodyguards, then the one and only bodyguard, under which office he captures the assassin of Darius III on that long march. He's made a general. He's decorated many times and becomes the commander of the Macedonian fleet. He is Ptolemy. At the death of the mighty conqueror, Alexander, it is he, Ptolemy, who suggests at the Babylon Council that the satrapies, the different groups of peoples that they were fighting over, be divided among the generals. Ptolemy is appointed the satrap of Egypt, using the Persian political division, satrap, as a starting place. He plants well. His piece of the pie lasts longer than all of the rest, until 30 BC, in fact. But in 321 BC, Ptolemy orders his men to bring Alexander's body to be buried in Egypt. From this, he expects political and even religious advantage. The immediate result is less encouraging. The furious Perdiccas, poised to take over the entire empire, marches against him, but is defeated. And when the dust settles, Ptolemy has added not only nearby Palestine, but also some northern portions of Syria, if only for a while. During much of this early period, Ptolemy has allied himself with Antigonus. Later, he fears his power and joins men in similar situations to his own, who are satrap-minded rather than empire-minded, to defeat Antigonus. Following in Alexander's steps, at least partially, Ptolemy tries to connect to the Egyptians by marrying the daughter of the former pharaoh. Of course, the most recent pharaoh is none other than Alexander himself. He was crowned pharaoh by the Egyptians in 331, shortly before creating Alexandria in his own honor. He never sees this city again, but Ptolemy follows up and chooses this city over history-laden Memphis as his capital. This is in 320. Two other women are to add to his power and content. His position is strengthened by marriage to Eurydice, the daughter of Antipater. But his affection seems to lean more to his own half-sister, the much younger Berenice, the great-granddaughter of the same Antipater. In 290, she becomes queen of Egypt. Now, how he is able to fuse his worship of Zeus to the standard gods of Egypt is the story of the cult of Serapis. In short, we say simply that the man was all things to all men, as a true Alexandrian had to be. The Romans would later follow this let-live policy. Seleucus in the north carried it to even greater extremes. Well, before his 40 years of reign end, Ptolemy I has jurisdiction over Libya, Cyrenaica, Arabia, parts of Syria, parts of Asia Minor, Cyprus, even a few Greek cities such as Corinth. The first 18 years he is general and satrap, but the last 22 he is soter, or savior, beginning in 305 when he declares himself king. That title is added in 304 when he's able to save the people of Rhodes from Antigonus. Though defeated by Antigonus in 306, he's generally victorious in battle, and no better example of how easy this could be than this one from Palestine. And I quote, "According to Josephus, his entry to that land is clothed in deceit. He enters on the Sabbath day, supposedly to offer sacrifice, but soon the city itself is a sacrifice to Zeus, as Ptolemy begins a reign of cruelty in the Holy Land. Now, though the start is bad, the captives taken to Egypt are raised to the privileged level of Macedonians. Jewish settlers there learn Greek and start a new life. Alexandria, under this general-turned-pharaoh, becomes a fountainhead of culture, art, and learning. He founds a library, builds a lighthouse called Pharos. Pharos becomes one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. And as a history person, Ptolemy details much of Alexander's campaign. Well, there can be no question that the king of the south, which is the one, this is what Ptolemy and his descendants will be called, the king of the south, whether measured by war or peacetime even, becomes strong, as the prophecy just said. At his death, he is raised to the god level by the appreciative Egyptians. Let me read 11:5a again. Then the king of the south shall become strong. Well, let's go to on in that same verse. We'll call it 11:5b. As well as one of his princes. And about the same time as Ptolemy, there rises to power one named Seleucus. We've talked about him. He's the son of Antiochus, the general of Philip II. Seleucus has been one of Alexander's most trusted generals. Now he takes the side of Perdiccas, who seems to be in line after Alexander, and who is one that might keep Alexander's ideals. When it becomes obvious that Perdiccas, like all the others, is after only his own power, he joins the group of Diadochi that kills Perdiccas. One of those with whom he now allies himself is Ptolemy, whom he has only recently tried to oust. In 321, Antipater, the new figurehead of power, appoints Seleucus governor of Babylon and points east. A few years later, he's used to head up a campaign against Eumenes, a supporter of Perdiccas and his ways. By 316, he leads Eumenes to his execution, but has a falling out with Antigonus and is driven out by him. He's allowed to flee into the care of Ptolemy, as mentioned before. This relationship lasts around 4 years, with Seleucus slowly putting his plans in order, consolidating power bases, making connections. He's certainly not fully comfortable with Ptolemy, but bides his time, waiting for the moment to strike back. He is the one responsible during this time for forging a coalition among Ptolemy, Lysimachus, Cassander, and of course himself. Seleucus is now made one of Ptolemy's princes or generals in a war against Demetrius, the son of Antigonus. In 312, he defeats Demetrius at Gaza, using troops supplied by Ptolemy. He then returns to his own region and allies himself with, among others, Chandragupta, an Indian monarch. Now here is one of those parts of the kingdom which have been, in, as it says in verse 4, uprooted even for others besides these. Alexander, even while living, and his men later, were not able to control all conquered areas. They did not even conquer some areas. And so with men like Chandragupta, it is time for terms, not termination. The negotiations are so friendly that the Indian sends 500 elephants to help Seleucus defeat Antigonus. 312 is the date given for the founding of the Seleucid Empire. Upon his return to the area, he takes Babylonia and establishes his turf. In 305, he calls himself king, as the other generals are beginning to do. And as already recorded, the Battle of Ipsus, fought by the reformed coalition described above, finally takes Antigonus out of the picture and allows Seleucus a free hand in this vast region of the former empire. More rivals come and go, but the claim holds. Not satisfied even yet, Seleucus defeats and kills Lysimachus, 281, the date others give as the end of the Diadochi struggles. That date because when he goes to Thrace to claim his new land, he too is assassinated by the son of Ptolemy I, who has died the year before. This particular son is a bit disgruntled since he, Ptolemy Cyranus, has been passed over as the next ruler of Egypt. And so Ptolemy and Seleucus are gone. Lysimachus is gone. Cassander is gone. The number of divisions of the empire is frozen at 4, just like God said. Now let me back up and read this again. 11:5b, as well as one of his princes, that prince being Seleucus. Well, moving on to part C of that verse, 11:5, part C, and he shall gain power over him and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion. So we've got the he and the him and the his, but no names. Well, history fills in the names. Seleucus, who reigns from the year 312 to 280, called the King of the North in relation to Israel. All of these directions are in relation to Israel. He reigns over, in today's term, Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Turkey, Armenia, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan. I'm talking about the modern nation's territory. That's a huge territory. His three capitals are Antioch of Syria, Seleucia in Iraq on the Tigris River, and Babylon in that same territory. His is a continuation of three major empires, the Babylonian, the Assyrian, and the Persian. It will be known as the Seleucid Empire by historians from this point on. One historian counts 72 separate kingdoms that became one under Seleucus. Though Syria, all of it, is assigned to Seleucus originally, Ptolemy has already occupied parts of it, especially the lower parts like Palestine and Lebanon. Though at first Seleucus does not enforce his claim, and perhaps out of something like civility for all the years spent working with Ptolemy, the Seleucids will eventually make a major issue of the Syrian border. In fact, most of this prophecy is taken up with this matter. The Syrian wars are at the heart of the vision of Daniel. Now, we talked about the successor wars. That's over. Now we're talking about the Syrian wars based out of Seleucid's territory. Anyway, he, Seleucus Nicator, the next one, conqueror, eventually gains power over him, Ptolemy, and the later Seleucids will have even greater sway over the Ptolemies. His dominion is a great dominion. And that's what I read to you from 11:5c. He shall gain power over him and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion. Totally, perfectly fulfilled. Now 11:6, part A, and at the end of some years, well, it's in fact about 28 years from the death of Seleucus Nicator until the events described in this verse. After he is murdered, seeking to take Thrace as his own, his son Antiochus the First, Antiochus the son of Seleucus. Now we've got a different group of men coming now. They started out as Seleucus. Now you'll see a group of men in the same family called Antiochus. He's the first of that. He's the son also of an Iranian princess, Apama. Seleucus, it seems, has been the most obedient to the vision of Alexander for a new world order, mixing the peoples of earth, east and west, into one. The wife assigned him by Alexander, he keeps. Antiochus begins his reign by paying proper, though to us improper, homage to his dad. He orders that Seleucus be venerated as Zeus Nicator, the conquering god. But Antiochus would have been a bit of a disappointment to his dad in other ways. Even though he, like Ptolemy I, is called Soter, savior, he has a hard time saving the empire from major shrinkage. There are independence movements in North Anatolia, we would call it Asia Minor, threats of war from Macedonia, and a directed harassment from a mass of 20,000 Gauls that cross over into Asia Minor. We call some of those people Galatians. Galatians, those are the ones that Paul wrote to, but we're getting way ahead here. He eventually defeats them and earns his badge as Savior, but there is a lessening of strength, and it is helped along by an attack from the new King of the South, the new Ptolemy, Ptolemy Philadelphus. There's war from 274 to 271, but nothing decisive happens. This is the first Syrian War. The Syrian wars are between the north and the south, Seleucids and Ptolemies. Philadelphus, for his part, still seems to have the upper hand in the north-south relation, that is. He has learned well from Papa how to relate to anyone born of Seleucus, and in fact is co-regent with his father for the first 2 to 3 years of his reign. His name, Philadelphus, brother-loving, may have reference to the fact that he married his full sister, Arsinoe II. 13 years before, he had married Arsinoe I, but he banishes this daughter of Lysimachus when politics intervene. Dad had his mini-harem, too. Also like father, Philadelphus is a man interested in building a great people and a great land. One of his best-known projects is the building of a canal linking the Nile to the Gulf of Suez. Like the Seleucids, this king is a devotee of the ruler cult and promotes the divinity of all Egyptian rulers. It is said that the Romans were later influenced by what they saw along these lines in the successor states. His father's peace with the Jews is likewise passed on. The high priest and company in Israel are permitted to become a political power just under Ptolemy. As long as the taxes are kept paid, the Jews fare well. Josephus relates the history of the Septuagint scriptures sponsored by Philadelphus. Ptolemy and high priest Eleazar exchange letters, creating the plan to send 6 elders of every tribe of Israel to Alexandria for the express purpose of translating the Hebrew scriptures into Greek. That would be 72. We think of 70 Septuagint being the 70 persons who put together the Old Testament in Greek. But some say there were 72. Well, in 261, another Antiochus, named Theos, or God, begins his reign in Antioch. He immediately declares war on Ptolemy in what is called the Second Syrian War. And perhaps this is in response to yet more shrinkage of the Seleucid Empire, a desperate attempt to save face. The conflict stretches on to about 253. Then it is clear that the only way for both sides to resolve this mess is, and let me go on to 11:6b, they shall join forces. The only way to solve the conflict is if they join forces. So the Lagidae, Ptolemies, and the Seleucidae need to get together to form an alliance. And the tool in this plan is again a young lady, her name Bernice, the daughter of Ptolemy II. And that's what chapter 11, verse 6c goes on to say, "For the daughter of the king of the south shall go to the king of the north to make an agreement." Trouble is, Antiochus II, Theos, already has a wife. His name is Laodice. His love and affection for her is so great that he names a city after her, Laodicea. But Ptolemy insists, "The affairs of state must take precedence over our petty desires. Take the woman." And so in 252, he takes her after a bitter divorce from Laodice. It is not clear to me why 2 wives could not be kept on. That was the normal thing in this situation. It could be that Laodice was the perpetrator of the divorce in reaction to her husband's proposed unfaithfulness. It must be an awful thing to be replaced by a political statement. But as we go on in the verse, "But she shall not retain the power of her authority." Who? Bernice's new position as queen of the former enemy territory is short-lived, maybe 5 or 6 years. Bernice is divorced and sent away. Laodice is recalled, like the benched quarterback who's got to fill in for the new star who's got a broken leg. Not too good a feeling, right? Antiochus has made a serious misjudgment of women, or at least of this one, because as I read on in the verse, and neither he nor his authority shall stand. That man Antiochus must die. The king Antiochus must be replaced. Poison will take care of both. And we might want to think this horror will not extend to Egypt, and then I'm going on in the verse, but she shall be given up. I hope you have your Bible open as I'm reading very slowly through a passage here, but giving you the details of what they mean. But I'm in 11:6 still. We're going to call this part F of 11:6, but she shall be given up. In fact, Bernice is given up to death, along with her infant son, who would have been Antiochus III. All that had a part in this plan, the father, Ptolemy, who dies shortly after Bernice is sent away, the poisoned husband, Antiochus, the nobles that accompany Bernice from Egypt, they're all dead. That's what God said would happen. She will die. She will die, and going on in the verse now, with those who brought her, and with him who begot her, and with him who strengthened her in those times. Laodice, her thirst for blood, temporarily assuaged, sets her son from Antiochus on the throne. History will remember him as Seleucus Callinicus, the year is 246. But moving on in the verse, but from a branch of her roots, one shall arise in his place. Ptolemy III is next in line in Egypt. He's called the benefactor, euergetes in Greek. His reign begins in 246, and he is definitely a branch of Bernice's parental roots. That's a special way of saying her brother. From a branch of her roots one shall arise. In other words, her brother shall arise. And he arose in the place of his father at his death. He must obviously be the one, and now I'm in 11:7, that last part was 11:7a, this is 11:7b. He must obviously be the one who shall come with an army. Are you there in 11:7? He shall come with an army. Euergetes, and with him all of Egypt, is outraged at Laodice's killing of Bernice and their son. The so-called Laodicean War, or the Third Syrian War, 246 to 241, ensues. As he must, and I'm now back in the verse, 11:7c, enter the fortress of the king of the north. Seleucus II Callinicus, the weak-kneed leader of the Syrian effort. Now, that's the king of the north. His reign also begins in 246, as both powers lose their government in the same few months. But he soon, this Antiochus, yields up his very capital to Euergetes, who has come to, as it says in the verse 7d, deal with them and prevail. It won't be the only loss of Seleucus II, nor the only win of Ptolemy III, but it is quite typical. Seleucus is suffering from these external pressures during his 20-plus years in office, and also from internal revolts. The pesky Laodice, about whom this war is being fought, and who happens to be his mother, sets him up against his own brother, Antiochus the Hawk, in Asia Minor. The resulting war of the brothers results in a division of the kingdom, which takes the two following administrations to heal. Bactria, which is Afghanistan, and then Parthia, which we would call Iran, break away. Though Seleucus's other name, Callinicus, means gloriously victorious, he isn't. The empire of his first namesake, Seleucus, has shrunk to its very lowest. He himself will die a prisoner in Parthia, about 226. At least one source adds that he dies from a fall from a horse. And this all happens several years before Ptolemy meets his creator, as his creator told ahead of time in the following verse. We'll get to it in a minute. So if you're keeping score, it'd be proper to give Seleucus Callinicus at least one point in his favor. That is, his son, Antiochus the Great. He leads a revival of the Seleucid event. But that's still two kings away. He'll be succeeded by Seleucus III, who after a three-year reign will succumb to that other, the brother actually, Antiochus III. Back to Ptolemy for now. He's on a roll. First on his agenda is 11:8a. Go there now. Chapter 11, verse 8, part A. He shall carry their gods captive to Egypt with their princes, that is, molded images, and their precious articles of silver and gold. It's said that what Euergetes actually discovers in Syria are long-lost idols and sacred treasures that had been stolen from Egypt by none other than Cambyses of Persia, way back in 524 BC. But in the midst of all the deep penetration into Syrian territory, Ptolemy is called back to Egypt due to domestic troubles. He certainly would have taken all of Syria had he been given the time, but then history would not have worked itself out as God foresaw. When Ptolemy goes home, Seleucus, now with some allies, recaptures much of the territory. The hand of God is keeping these powers separate for a reason. But at least, as is noted in verse 8, at least he shall continue more years than the king of the north. He shall continue more years than the king of the north. In just a few years, in the year 240, Syria has regrouped and recovered. So, and I'm in 11:9 now. So then the king of the north shall come to the kingdom of the king of the south, but shall return to his own land. Yes, Callinicus, he actually tries an all-out attack on Ptolemy, but he's beaten again. And tail between his legs, he has to move quickly back to Mama and safety, as such as it is. A measure of peace prevails from 240 until 221 when Euergetes is dead. And dying with that Ptolemy seems to be also the expansionist ways of Egypt. Though Ptolemy III has been a great success and brought new wealth to his people, the tides seem to be turning toward the north. Upon his death in 221, wife Bernice II becomes the joint heir with her son, Ptolemy IV. For this effort, Ptolemy has her murdered. And before his own surprise death in 203, he will have killed not only his mother, but his brother, his uncle, and maybe his sister who doubled as his wife. Dysfunction rules in these Macedonian families. Well, we're in 11:10, part A. However, his sons, plural, shall stir up strife. Well, his sons are Seleucus III, Soter, and these names seem to reappear every few years, sometimes in the north, but sometimes in the south. And his other son, Antiochus III Magnus, that is, the Great. Seleucus is a weak king, but wants very much to recover what his father has lost. He tries indeed, but lacking skills of leadership, he cannot rule his own army, and is so disrespected as to finally be poisoned by his friends. His entire reign is about 3 years. Now his brother Antiochus, it's a different story. He takes the throne upon Seleucus' tragic death as a boy in his late teens. And though so young, he has already gained valuable experience as a governor of Babylonia under his brother. He immediately tries to conquer Ptolemy. And so both sons stir up strife against Egypt, as the word says. And then in moving on with verse 10, both of them assemble a multitude of great forces, and one shall certainly come and overwhelm and pass through. Notice how the text starts with a plurality, but ends in the singular. Seleucus tries and fails. Now Antiochus's major effort is recorded, in advance, of course. And before documenting the anti-Egypt campaign, I should first reintroduced the ruler of Egypt in those days. It's another Ptolemy, of course. He's the fourth. Philopater, which means father love, which is not the greatest name for him. He's the family murderer, the most cruel and vicious of all the Ptolemies. He's called a drunk. It's recorded that he is completely under the control of his favorites at the court. On his cruel side, he especially hates the Jews and persecutes them without mercy. It's easy to understand why Israel, in general, turns toward the north for help. The stage is now set for the fourth Syrian war. Antiochus Magnus at first defeats Philopater and begins to take territory north of Egypt, as far as Gaza. Tyre and Ptolemais are hit. And in 218, his is Lebanon and Palestine and Phoenicia. And then in verse 10, part C, then he shall return to his fortress and stir up strife. It's said that while Antiochus is besieging Dora, he's forced to retire to Ptolemais for the winter. And then in the spring of 217, Ptolemy, the king of the south, fights the king of the north. And I'm going to stop right there. It's a new section in my writing here. We're going to be talking now about the further reign of Antiochus the Great. He's the main subject here. He's not the ultimate subject, but for a while he is front and center. And do join with us again. So glad that you could be with us today. And this is the Hackberry House of Chosun. Lord willing, we'll talk again real soon. Bye-bye.